Good morning, diners, travelers, wherever you might be. You're listening to On the Menu, as usual, I'm hoping. You'll notice that I'm back.
Yeah, guess who's back, isn't it? This is wonderful news. The most excited person in the whole of the world is Peter.
And good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, and we have a wonderful lineup, so it's good to come back with a big roar here. Amelia Saltzman is our first guest. She's the author. She's a frequent writer of just about everything having to do with food. Amelia, hello.
Oh, hello.
You're there. Okay.
Peter, it's so nice to be with you today.
Great.
Especially on your first day back.
Yeah. Well, this is a change from what I've been doing. It's been longer than 6 weeks, actually. But and anyway, we are back, and I have had plenty of time to read your book, The Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, which is a delight.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that before I picked it up, when I looked at all of the what do you call those acknowledgments and from all the other authors?
Oh yes, on the back of the book.
Oh, I mean, just everybody. It's a who's who of the people who really know about the farmers movement and food and where we are in contemporary America today. So, I mean, you have Joan Nathan, you've got Lynn, I call her by her maiden name, but it's Casper.
Right, Rosetto Casper.
Yeah. Yes. Nancy Silverton, Alice Waters, Susan Guin. I mean, just like everybody. Now, why is it, do you suppose, let's start with, give us the premise of your book.
Well, you know, the premise of my book, Em, is actually the subtitle of the book. Seasonal foods, simple recipes, and stories from the market and farm. To me, that's the true title, the true universal message of my book. I wanted to talk about the extraordinary flavor that comes from shopping seasonally, cooking the foods simply, and understanding a little bit more from the farmers about how our food is grown and why that's so important.
Yeah, now, I mean, it is a wonderful farmer's market.
Well, that is true. That is true. Have you ever had a chance to be in our little beachside town with the greatest farmer's market in the country?
You bet we have.
Well, it is quite remarkable. And, you know, the Santa Monica Farmer's Market has taken 26 years to get to where it is today. It's developed just as a small little market, you know, a few tables with some boxes thrown on it. And the idea was at the time by the Santa Monica mayor to revitalize a very sleepy, rather depressed downtown. And boy, did it ever.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that, actually. I guess I hadn't understood that it was a redevelopment project in a way.
Well, it is, and many farmers markets are fill that bill. There is an interesting mix of helping each other not only to save and protect our farmland in relatively urban areas, but also to help to use maintain a great sense of central city. So it's a very synchronistic and symbiotic relationship. If we just get behind it, it helps the small growers. And it helps the city.
Now, I'm getting signals. Are we to do a timeout?
No, it's okay.
Oh, it's okay. So we're going to move on. Amelia, could you put this in the context of the overall, across-the-board rise of farmers' markets and the farm-to-table movement?
Oh, I'd be happy to. You know, really, over the last generation, particularly the last 10 years, we've all become increasingly aware of the need to pay attention to our food.
It's scary, isn't it, if you don't?
Well, it is scary. It is scary, except when you are looking eye to eye with the person who grew your food. You know, those of us who've been shopping at good farmers markets these last 10 years, we're not feeling quite as scared.
Right, exactly.
So the scary part is that we need everybody to think locally and seasonally more than they have been, because we're in trouble.
Right. Now, I mean, it's amazing to me, though, how many farms are still, small family farms, as devastated as they've been, are on the rise again.
Absolutely. And you know, I don't know what the situation is like for you over where you are. But
very good, by the way.
Very good. There are many people who have a passion for farming and are going into it as a second or third career. They are realizing their dream. So that many of the farmers at our farmers markets have been classical musicians, architects, nurses, teachers, but have come into this as to realize a dream. It's not necessarily saving a farm, a generations-old farm, but people coming into it because they believe, because they're passionate, because they love the land.
Yeah, no, I've actually been tempted by, when I look at cute little goats, I've been tempted, but fortunately I've resisted that. Amelia, the other thing about your book is not only do you talk and tell stories about the farmers at your market, your recipes are seasonal, are they not?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's how you get the best flavor and the way that you can know that you're buying locally. If it's in season, there's a good chance that it was grown in your neck of the woods. If it's in season, things taste best when grown in their season. So you're going to get better flavor by buying something that was meant for this particular time of the year in your particular climate. And when that happens, cooking is so easy. We always talk about how little time we have in our day. Well, you know what? If the farmer does all the work and you've got this great ingredient, you have almost nothing to do but add maybe a little olive oil, a little salt, some thyme in a hot oven, or maybe just tossing those raw ingredients in a salad bowl, and you have a great meal, a seasonal, simple meal.
Of course, you do have an advantage. I mean, I'm looking at the section on citrus. I mean, citrus in southwestern Pennsylvania is pretty ludicrous.
Well, that's true, you know, but we don't get a lot of rhubarb in the spring, I'll tell you that.
No, you don't.
But, you know, that's how we know where we are, what grows in your neighborhood, what specialties you have. That's how I know I'm someplace else. And if I came to visit you, I'd want to go to your farmer's market to get a sense of place, a sense of time, a sense of place, and know I was somewhere else other than my home city.
Now, we just got a book of 150 favorite recipes from the author of the Moosewood Cookbook. I was curious as to which were your favorite recipes, because there's so many wonderful. They're very interesting. Readers, this truly, the recipes themselves, aside from the history and the insights into the market, are really out of the ordinary. What are some of your favorites?
Well, some of my favorites are the very simplest recipes using the most familiar ingredients, because those, in a way, provide the biggest surprise, the difference it can make. So a perfect example is baked applesauce. We are in the height of apple season right now all over the country. Wherever you are, we've got great apples, a lot of varieties, and with tremendous flavor. So, and that's another point, is that when you go to a farmer's market, a lot of times you're finding people growing many interesting varieties. Do you know that there are 4,000 varieties of apples? Most of us only know about 2 or 3 or 4. Now, of course, none of us will ever experience 4,000 varieties, but at a farmer's market, you're likely to find Northern Spy, Cortland, McIntosh, Spitzenberg, unusual varieties that many of them are hundreds of years old, great complexity of flavor. So if you start with an incredible apple like that, then all you need to make this dish is a knife, a pan, and a piece of foil, and an oven. That's it. And you will have the best applesauce you've ever tasted. And all I did was crank up the oven to about 375, cut the apples in half. I didn't skin them. And I scooped out the core, and I put them in the pan, cut side down, covered them with the pan with the tin foil, or aluminum foil, I guess you say, put them in the oven for 30 minutes, took out the pan. Then what happens is the skins just lift right off the apple, no peeling, no pureeing, nothing. I scooped out the flesh, mashed it up in the pan, added a little bit of water. What I had were sort of the caramelized bits on the bottom of the pan where the surface of the apple hit the heat and brought out all the natural flavors. It is amazing. The flavor is so concentrated. And that is really a perfect example of how simple a dish can be when you start with a great ingredient and just tweak it ever so lightly. Understand its sort of chemistry, if you will, to bring out its natural flavors. And it's perfect. It's just so wonderful. Plus, it's easy. There's no blender to wash. There's no food mill to clean. You need a fork to mash it. That's it. And it's really fabulous.
I just read on the flyleaf here that this is your first book. I guess I've read so many of your magazine articles that I'm really surprised that this is your first book.
Oh, well, you
but
know.
But you do all the media, I mean, all the radio and so forth stuff too, don't you?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, every time it's hard to settle down to one big project when you have so many stories you want to tell and get out there and so many different ways. And about 3 years ago, I sat down and said, or 2 years ago, I guess it is, and said, okay, nothing else. It's time to get it into book form and let it have a bigger life. I really want to share this discovery of how easy it can be to eat well, healthily, deliciously, and simply.
And well, now the book is called
Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, now, Seasonal Foods, Simple Recipes, and Stories from the Market and Farm.
And there are wonderful stories about why the market came together, when it had difficult times, how it recovered from those.
Yeah, the chef's effort.
It's a wonderful destination. And one of the things I noticed that you said in there is that it's important that chefs should go to farmers markets instead of just sitting by the phone and calling suppliers.
Absolutely. The chefs all over this country have an extraordinary opportunity to help sustain small farms. People pay attention to what chefs are doing, and they want to see local foods on the restaurant menus. And chefs can buy in quantity, and they can make it known, you know, what the farmers are growing. And the other thing that has happened, many of the varieties that we have at our local markets came about because of dialogue between chefs and farmers, home cooks and farmers, saying, well, gee, you know, I've grown this interesting thing, and the chef will say, oh, gee, I'm going to try experimenting with that. And the next thing you know, it's on a menu. Customers are really interested, then going to the farmers market, buying it themselves. Or somebody's writing about the chef in a magazine, and then the rest of the country is hearing about fresh garbanzo beans or Meyer lemons or all of the things that we're beginning to know about. It's helping to spread the word. Or a chef will come to a farmer and say, you know, I was in Italy, and there's always this great Tuscan kale called Cavolo Nero. Will you grow it? I'll bring you seeds.
Yeah, I've tried that one, by the way.
Yeah, we actually have some growing in our garden.
It was terrible.
It wasn't immensely successful, but we tried. Well, listen, Amelia, we have to go take a break shortly. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
And listeners, pick up this. Go to our website and get this book. It's on the website under OTM Bookshelf.
Thank you. And we will take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. On the line, we also have our next guests, Dan Smith and Steve McDonough. Hi, Dan and Steve.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having us.
But we we wouldn't necessarily recognize their last names because their last names aren't nearly as well known as their, shall we call it, their stage name?
Right. Well, they are the Hardy Boys. And the book we're talking about is the Hardy Boys Cookbook. The full title, Talk With Your Mouth Full.
Which my mother would never have allowed.
Exactly.
So that's the background for this title?
A couple of different things about the title, one of them being that we were both cater waiters. We started at the very bottom in the business and worked our way up. So we have a lot of stories to tell in the book, and that's part of why we called it that.
Yeah, we just wanted to be a collection of, you know, stories and recipes and anecdotes, fun stuff like that. And it also reflects our irreverent view of entertaining.
Now, what is irreverent about your view?
What's irreverent? You know, we just want there to be a real comfort level and accessibility to everyone's parties. We are not the guys in the tuxedos and silver platters. You know, it's food that people can make on their own, and we really focus more on the celebration than anything else.
And, you know, also part of what we believe is that it's just food. You know, it's not brain surgery, so you should have fun with it. You should experiment with it. You shouldn't be afraid of it.
Now, you are both actors. Now, I'm going to risk having everybody throw in their day job and take up catering. When I said, tell our listeners how you got to do what you're doing, and we should throw in right early on that you also are Food Network stars.
Thank you.
We do. We've got our fingers in a lot of pies, you know, literally. We just started out as actors in New York, and when you are an actor in New York, you're in the food business, you know, in between jobs, you just are. So we worked both front of house and back of house and catering and restaurants. So we like to say that, you know, we didn't go to culinary institutes for this. We learned in the trenches and became what we call accidental experts.
Right. I read that. Accidental experts. Very good. But you do have a very successful catering company.
We do, yeah. We are based in Chicago on the north side. Great space.
So you're not in New York now?
No. We've always been in Chicago.
Our business has always been in Chicago.
Yeah.
That's right.
We taped the show in New York, but we've been based here in Chicago for probably about 10 years now.
Great restaurant scene developing in Chicago.
It's such a hot food town. It really is. It challenges us all the time. I think people think, oh, you're a caterer and you're going to pull out, you know, wet beef and mostaccioli, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's a challenge to feed people in a sophisticated, urban, hip way, bringing it from your catering business, you know, to a van and a hot box and reheating it and making sure it looks the same for, you know, the clients that have wedding for 300, you know, so it's a lot of fun. It's challenging.
So you're doing platters like a linear, I guess.
not quite like a linear, but you know, I would match our food up against just about any restaurant in Chicago.
Okay, so you think you're right up there.
Well, I hope so. As far as caterers, yeah. You know, Grant Atkins has been one of our sous chefs for a long time. Yes, you know,
this is his day job.
Charlie Trotter sometimes comes in and bartends for us.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he does.
They're learning some good stuff.
Now, Paul Kahan from Blackbird probably does come in.
Paul.
Now, what is your typical event?
Gosh, you know, that's the cool thing about being a caterer is there's really no typical event. I mean, we do everything from dinner parties for 10 to 12 people on up to cocktail parties and small plate parties for 1,000 people.
That's a lot.
And that's what's exciting about it. That, you know, I never get bored with the business because you're always doing something different.
Because the menus have to change. People will often say, what kind of food do you do? But as a caterer, you're not a restaurateur. You know, we're not always doing Italian, like an Italian restaurant.
Yeah, talk about Italian. Now, who's what now? Steve, why don't we each do a brief background? Because, Steve, you learned Italian, didn't you?
No, Dan did.
Don't let the name fool you. My last name is Smith. My dad is English and Polish and a few other things. But my mom's Italian. So you know, I grew up with my Italian
grandparents. Dan is the one with the red shirt.
yeah, that's right. The names are switched on the front of the book.
Yeah, and you know, there, I went through, there is no place where it really identifies you.
We like to be mysterious that way.
I see, all right. So tell us your backgrounds.
Like I said, you know, I'm half Italian, but I grew up with my grandparents in the same house. So, you know, I'm a product of a true Italian family where you had those 6 and 7 hour sit-down Sunday dinners. We actually had one of those just yesterday. My mom is in town watching our son while we're on the book tour. We happened to be back in town, and she made a huge lasagna dinner.
With fresh pasta, stuffed with sausage and homemade meatballs, and also she made brujol because she knows that, you know, she's always welcome to stay if she makes me brujol.
It's cool. And what about Steve?
Well, for me, I grew up in an English family, and so, I mean, you can draw whatever conclusions you want to from that.
Yeah, I know. I'm married to one.
I grew up with a mother who didn't like to eat very much and like to cook even less.
Right.
So the only thing you could be sure about in our house was that the food on the plate was well and truly dead.
Okay. Well, with us, it was always, the plate was always exactly the same. It was a meat, a potato, and a vegetable. And I grew up, my mom was a single mother, working mother in the 1970s, so, I mean, money was kind of tight, and, you know, we all chipped in. And so I did a lot of cooking, even as a kid.
Oh, you did?
I did, and just, you know, just for the family. And what I found was, that's where I found a love of cookbooks, because I think that anyone that can read a recipe and follow directions can cook. As you know, as long as you can follow directions, you can cook. And from there, you learn to make your own substitutions and make a recipe your own. And so that's how I started. I think that's where the love of food came for me.
Here's the funny thing. I'm the Italian one, and I didn't start cooking really until I was about 28 years old, because I had an Italian mother to cook for me.
Oh, see, I had the same deal.
Yeah, Anne was the same one. She didn't have to cook for herself until she went away to graduate school.
Uh-huh.
Now, you have so many interesting recipes here. They all seem to be fairly approachable. Was that one of the goals of your book?
Totally is one of the goals, and one of the nice things is that's the feedback that we get both from people who watch the show and people who have tried recipes out of the book. They're easy to make. The nice thing, though, is that they don't look like they're easy once you put them on the table.
Yeah, they look difficult and
they look
elegant.
Fancy.
Yeah, and elegant, yeah.
Yeah, I always say that throwing a good dinner party or any kind of event is not in breaking your butt to create this meal. It's about giving the illusion that you broke your butt to make this meal.
Right. Now, your artichoke.
And if you're lazy, I guess you can always eye Steve and Dan.
We have no problem with people who don't know how to cook. That's how we stay alive ourselves.
Your artichoke fritters look so unusual to me. They're not all chopped up.
That's the great thing. You know, and that's what I love about fritters anyway, is that, you know, they should have chunks of whatever is, you know, you're calling it an artichoke fritter, it should have chunks of artichoke in it.
Uh-huh.
I love that. You know, so you bite into it and you've got that really great, warm, floury dough, but then you bite into a huge piece of artichoke heart as well.
What we also like specifically about that recipe is that you can use it not just for a hors d'oeuvre, but you can serve it as a first course. Put a, you know, with some lightly dressed greens, put them out there. We used to do them at our restaurant that way.
Exactly.
And tell me that. You never told me about your restaurant.
Our restaurant is HB. It's in Chicago as well, and it's again just really accessible, comfort food, and just but done really well.
When do you have time to do all this? Huh? I mean, you do the Food Network, you write, you do catering for all kinds of things, and now you have a restaurant.
You know, we have a world domination thing going on that we're, you know, it's all on the schedule.
Now, how did you pick Hardy Boys for your name?
I read all the Hardy Boys books when I was growing up. And when I opened the business, I thought, oh, you know, it'd be fun to change the spelling of it and use that as the name of the company.
Plus,
and
it also stopped you from getting sued, I guess.
Exactly.
Good point. But it also reflects the kind of food that we do. A lot of times when we were opening, people would say hearty, so that means heart healthy, right? And we'd be like, no, that's not what it means. It means you're having a party, You're having really good, really abundant food.
And it's hearty.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Hearty, I guess, is an English word more than it. I think it's not really a terribly American word.
Hearty?
Hearty.
Good point. I mean,
do,
right.
Do you give a hearty cheer?
Yeah, exactly.
Really.
Yeah,
let's have a hearty cheer for all the veterans, though, who were at the football game yesterday or whatever else it might be.
There's a Shakespearean term that Shakespearean quote them about the massacre. Something that's eat hearty, young lads, for tomorrow we die. Something close to that.
I think that was probably Henry V before one of the battles against the French.
There you go.
Which the British won anyway.
Yeah.
And I think it was the Feast of St. Crispin as well, as I recall.
But okay.
We're a wealth of trivia.
Yeah, Welsh of trivia. There we go. You have to have a little trivia. Now, I have to say, in talking with Dan and Steve, you're totally seamless. I mean, you sound like you're almost one person. How do you manage that?
Gosh, you know, good question. A lot of people say that about us, and I think it's just a natural thing. It's not something we have to work on. I think the fact that we've known each other for over 20 years now, we've worked together for probably 11 of those years, has a lot to do with it. But you know, we get along really well. We don't have to work at it. It's just a natural.
This is your first book?
Yes, we're beginning work on a second book. The other really cool thing that we've just started, it's exclusive to us. No one has ever done this before. In the front part of our catering space, we have a storefront, and we have built a TV studio kitchen. And what we're doing is an event space called HBTV for Hardy Boys Television. It's a TV studio kitchen with a live feed, you know, an internal live feed. Dan and I come in and we do a quick 3-minute demo and tell everybody what we just did. You know, we worked on a teleprompter, we were finding our culinary point of view, road mapping our food, using swap outs, and then the audience gets up in front of the camera because it looks so easy. Food TV looks so easy, so we throw them in front of the camera and they get their own shot at it and they bring home a DVD of the experience. It's great fun.
It's like cooking karaoke.
It sounds like there must be some really terrible television there.
That's what we want. Yeah, we don't need the competition. That's what makes it funny.
Yeah, and did a show that never aired. What was it called? It was a reality show called Food Fight, and she said it was just absolutely terrible.
It was so horrible. They had amateurs cooking, and the judges, we had to eat the stuff, and I took a bite of broccoli. And I couldn't chew it. I mean, I just absolutely could not chew it. I could barely have cut it with a steak knife. And they zoomed in on my mouth with the camera. It was terrible.
It gives you huge respect for what these Iron Chef guys do. I mean, what it is that they're capable of doing under time pressure. It's really quite amazing.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you two, give us details here. I mean, there's so much going. The book, everyone can go on our website, which is... onthemenuradio.com under OTM bookshelf and find this book, which is called Talk With Your Mouth Full, the Hardy Boys Cookbook, and you can order that. Now, give us the other details. Your restaurant is in Chicago. Go ahead.
It's in Chicago. It's in the Lakeview neighborhood on Halsted, 3404 North Halsted. Our new space, HBTV, is at 3819 North Broadway.
In Chicago, it's just right up the road from where we started. And let me see, the book is available kind of everywhere. Yeah, you said on your website. We're doing
on our website,
and your
too.
Show. Oh, yeah, and give us your website.
It's hardyboys.com, and just about everything that we're doing is right on the website. So
and it's
H-E-A-R-T-Y, hardy like lots of boys.com. And we put it on the website so that we can personalize them and send them out. We've got product and stuff on there as well. Plus, you know, there's a lot of our whole schedule is on there. So as we're doing our tour, if people want to check out and see when we're going to be in their neighborhood, we've got our whole schedule on there as well.
Aren't they the pits of those book tours?
it's been a lot of work, but we really love meeting everybody.
I was going to say that's the one saving grace is meeting all these people in all these places.
Yeah, because we're not getting to eat well. We just were in Napa, and we were doing a cooking class until like 10:30, so all the restaurants were closed. We're in Napa,
dear.
And we ate at a
And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remind you, please check out our website, which is www.onthemenuradio.com. And a reminder that all the books that we discuss can generally, probably absolutely, be found on our website under OTM Bookshelf, and you can just click right through and order them. And if we want to talk about them, they're probably worth your reading. Anyhow, our current guest is Phoebe Damrosch. Hello, Phoebe. I loved your book.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah. The book is called Service Included, The Four-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. Can you explain that? Phoebe,
sure.
Tell us about your background here.
Sure. Well, I started working in restaurants as a day job. I was a writer, and I was getting my MFA in nonfiction writing. And I needed a day job, and then I ended up falling in love with it. So I worked for 18 months at Per Se, which is Thomas Keller's restaurant in the Time Warner Center in New York City, very extensive tasting menus. And I really found the whole subculture of people who work in restaurants, and especially at the really high end, to be fascinating, and realized that I was standing in the middle of a book-worthy topic.
Uh-huh.
So I found it, you know, fairly easy, I think, compared to most people, to sell the book, which spoke to me of the interest in restaurants and food in this country right now.
And Thomas Keller.
And Thomas Keller, right.
Yes. Who is, I mean, we happen to know Thomas. He's intriguing, is he not?
He is. He's at the top of his game.
Uh-huh.
And I think unlike some celebrity chefs who get their celebrity by being on television and putting on a show, I think he does not do that. I think he's really known for his cooking.
What next?
Now, listeners will actually have a chance to judge that for themselves, because Thomas's interview is coming up next. It's a pre-recorded interview. He did tell me, Phoebe, that he had a copy of your book on his desk, but he hadn't opened it yet.
Right.
That was nice. That was really nice.
I've heard that from a lot of people. I'm starting to wonder if it's a common answer.
What do you think it means?
I don't know. I think it might be trying to be polite.
Well, could be.
Well, Anne read the book from cover to cover. So.
I did. I kept waiting to hear, I told you, before we got on air, I kept waiting to hear what happened with Laura, his partner.
Right, and too bad you can't ask him that yourself, because it's pre-recorded in the next interview.
I asked him a couple of questions I thought he might not answer, but I was pretty sure he wouldn't answer that one.
He wouldn't answer that one.
So I didn't ask him that one.
Yeah, a lot of people in the food world want to know the answer to that question.
Right, well, yeah. Your book, you talk a lot about the whole concept of service and what's involved with it. And you seem to be really sold on it.
Well, I think it's kind of the missing link right now in restaurants. I think we're fascinated by chefs. We all watch Top Chef and Iron Chef and read cookbooks cover to cover. But for some reason, people who work in the front of the house, in the dining room, have this sort of sense of shame about what they do, and a lack of pride in the whole art of service and hospitality. And I think if we're going to take restaurants to the next level, we really need to start addressing that.
That's a very American aspect of it. I mean, Europe, they don't have that idea.
Yeah, I have a theory about it, Phoebe, which is fed on the fact that if you think American waiters are poor, you should try the ones in Australia, which are really terrible. And I think the reason is that it's such a democratic country, and the master... No, there is definitely a master-servant kind of relationship,
right,
that exists at the dining table in the restaurant, just like used to happen in homes where there were servants and there was the master. So I think there's almost a rebellion against that in truly democratic countries like,
right,
Australia and the United States, where being in service is not a profession.
Right.
It's just a job.
Whereas in some places, like at Per Se, it's a wonderful profession. People, you know, we had healthcare and dental and 401k, and there were people there who could make six figures, unlike a lot of other jobs that were available to me, at least.
Now, the comparison I was making really was in Europe,
right?
Where being in service, it absolutely is a career decision,
right,
and it's a career job.
And here, it's usually a day job. Right. And but the irony, of course, is that waiters are paid so much better than chefs, who are better trained and working longer, harder hours.
And that's behind the theory behind, or the fact behind this 20% assigned.
Right.
And do you want to explain that?
Right. Well, I can't talk too much about it because I left before it was actually instituted. But the point was that 20% was added to all the prices across the board in the restaurant, so that people were able to be the front of the house was able to be paid a salary, just like they were in the kitchen, and hopefully the kitchen could be paid a little bit higher as well. I'm not sure if that worked and how it actually ended up turning out.
Well, I keep reading. In fact, I just read again that some restaurants actually assign a 20% fee to checks for Englishmen.
Yeah.
Since I'm married to one, I understand.
We used to talk about that, actually. The restaurant I worked before, where a European table, we would hope that we could add 20%. And then we also used to fantasize about the eject button for certain really high-maintenance guests.
Well, you seem to have had a good time, though, with all the characters that you worked with.
I had a great time. And, you know, you asked me about the title, and the subtitle of the book is Four Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. And I use eavesdropping because I think it's A, the way you are good at your job as a waiter. You have to pay attention, you have to
right.
overhear things. And also it was what made the job interesting. And I'm not talking about dirty secrets, I'm just talking about watching people be who they are when they think they're not being observed.
Uh-huh. Now, how was the client, the customer at Per Se or at French Laundry, how were they different from your average restaurant customer?
Well, from the opening, it sort of went in waves. So at first we had really highly informed foodies and critics. And then we went through a period where we had a lot of celebrities who were kind of had heard that it was a hot table and didn't really know what they were getting into. And then more tourists. And, you know, it was across the board a pretty diverse group. However, I think compared to other clientele that I had seen, I think it was a dream group of people just because they would turn themselves over to the chef and just kind of go with the flow as opposed to the kind of sauce on the side type of diner that I had waited on before.
Uh-huh. Now, I mean, clearly Thomas's perfection, we'll call it perfectionism, mm-hmm. Came through in terms of the lineup of the dining room and how things had to be done, right?
Right. Yeah, we were supposed to train for a month, and we ended up training for 3 months because we had a fire in the kitchen.
Oh, I remember that.
Right. They used that time to train us a little bit further. So it was very apparent to me from the beginning just what level that I was working at. We had, in the mornings, we would have people come in and speak to us about food and give us lectures on caviar and truffles and foie gras and veal stock, everything about the food so we could really become familiar with it, and we were able to speak about it at the tables. And then in the afternoon, we would practice service. And one thing I write about in the book, which really showed me the level at which I was working, was that they brought in an 18th century dance specialist.
Oh, yes.
Just had a move in the dining room. I don't know if that actually worked, but I think just the fact that they went to that level really showed us something as a staff.
See, I can see how that would be important. Actually, yeah. I've heard about that other places, too. What was so special about you that you got promoted like that? I mean, that was a little unusual. You better mention to the people who have not read the book yet, our listeners, about how you progressed.
Right. I started out as a back waiter, which meant that I was serving bread and water and not talking much. And then I was promoted to captain. And I think most of the reason I was promoted was that I was a woman and they were looking for a little bit more diversity on the floor.
Okay.
And I think that comes from Laura Cunningham, who designed the whole service standard at the French Laundry and was looking for a more diverse group, a younger group than you might find at another really high-end French restaurant. And also, I was really passionate about food and wine and really excited about what I was doing. And I think that really came through. My one real weakness was that I didn't know much about wine.
Uh-huh.
And so I was paired with Andre, who is the head sommelier, who ends up being the love interest in the book, because he was supposed to be tutoring me on wine.
Uh-huh.
And you're still good friends, I understand.
We are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Throughout the book, you have these tips that you give diners.
Right. This is fun. I sent out a mass email to all of my restaurant friends as I was writing the book and asked them to send me their pet peeves. And then I collected them all and wrote them in little tips for diners. But then I felt like I was being a little unfair and coming down hard on diners. So then I wrote a Bill of Rights on the first page of the book for what diners should expect and what they can ask for.
Okay. But here are some of these tips. is do not touch your waiter. I thought that was pretty good.
Now what do you do about when the waiter touches you?
They're not supposed to do that either.
We have experienced that. We have experienced that.
Yeah.
I think we've experienced just about that.
It can be a little disquieting. Now,
I mean, eating for a living, I think we've really experienced just about all of this.
Now, Phoebe, you did promise before we came on the air that there were some stories that you wanted to share, but that you really didn't feel like you could publish.
Yeah, you know.
Can you give us a couple of those?
Well, that was really the hardest part of the book, is trying to figure out what to put in, what not to put in. And I remember my first meeting with the publisher, they asked me that question, what are you not going to tell in this book? And I think the majority of what I left out was the really snarky, complaining, gossipy stuff.
That's the fun stuff.
Well, it is, except that I was going to have to live with this book and myself for the rest of my life. And I was more interested in what made the restaurant work as opposed to what made it not work.
Okay. Well, since this recording will essentially be on the menu website forever, but it won't be on a printed page. So you have to tell us a couple of things.
Well, you know, chefs lose their tempers, and waiters make a lot of mistakes, and diners behave atrociously.
What was the worst episode of the diners misbehaving?
For some reason, this just came into my head that a lot of times you'd see an older gentleman with one or two much, much younger ladies and sort of wonder where he found them.
Yeah.
And that was always really interesting. I found it really interesting to try to make up stories about the different people sitting at the tables and figure out how they knew each other and who was paying whom.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And what
about...
I left out
a lot about celebrities. I could have written a whole chapter on celebrities.
Well, tell us some of those. Dish those, please.
Well... it was everyone who's everyone came in, from politicians to actors to news people, and it was interesting to see which combinations of people came in. Like, for example, I couldn't figure out why Mario Batali and Gwyneth Paltrow would be sitting together, and then they just came out with this food show together, and it was like, oh, that makes sense.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. What is the food? I missed that. Which he's doing another project, I guess.
Yep, they're doing it.
Oh, in Spain. Yeah. All right. And the very worst waiter error that you could think of.
I remember one. This actually had to do with touching your waiter, so now we'll come full circle. Oftentimes, waiters get involved in monetary disputes, and they'll have someone try to hand money to you or slip a credit card to you.
That's awful.
And I remember someone giving me his credit card, but I hadn't even realized that he had slipped it into my pocket, and then I was supposed to be ringing it up on his credit card and ended up ringing it up on someone else's, and there was this huge fight about it.
Oh, no.
And then he's like, well, look in your pocket. And I had no idea that he had put it in there. It's very uncomfortable on many levels.
Oh, yeah. Now, what's the best thing you have to say about American service?
Well, when I think it really works is when it's a little bit more authentic, when you really get a sense of the waiter's personality. Not that they're your best friend or that they're sitting down at your table and telling you their name, but just that you get a real sense of who they are. And I think we were definitely encouraged to be our own people as opposed to the sort of stodgy Frenchman, who just says, of course, every 2 seconds, or enjoy.
Okay, and what do we have to really work on in terms of service?
Paying attention. I think most of the times when I get really frustrated with servers myself, it's just that I can tell that they don't want to be there and they have absolutely no interest in food and wine. And, you should never have to flail around trying to get your waiter's attention. You should be able to look up and make eye contact.
Yeah, I got you exactly. Now, the funny part about it is, of course, it's rumored that French waiters are trained to be rude, because it's in bistro type restaurants, it's almost sort of an expected thing.
Right.
We had a joke in Pittsburgh about a restaurant called Klein's, mm-hmm. where it seemed all the waitresses were old ladies, and so there was this simile, as rude as a Klein's waitress.
Right.
And then it seemed like it was a special part of what they did.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, Phoebe, what's next for you? More writing, you said.
More writing. I'm doing some freelancing in food publications, and I'm also working on a book proposal. So, yeah, keep writing. Keep trying to not wait tables, but it's always there if I need it. That's what I keep telling myself.
So you don't expect there'll be a movie version?
I've had a bunch of conversations about movies and TV. Nothing's happened yet, but I'll keep you posted.
Okay, do that.
Great. Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining the program. And listeners, the book is called again, Anne, what's it called?
Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. And the author is Phoebe Damrosch.
Phoebe, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye, Phoebe.
And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net. Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio.
On the Menu is delighted to have the opportunity to welcome Chef Thomas Keller to Pittsburgh. We caught up with him because he's doing a very special event this evening and a book signing at Williams-Sonoma tomorrow. But Thomas, tell us first of all, why Taste America? What is this program about that brings you to Pittsburgh?
Yeah, Taste of America is a wonderful program. It's the first year we've done this. It's a James Beard-sponsored event. And what we're trying to do, the goal is to have chefs from around the country, well-known chefs, Beard Award winners specifically, take their show on the road, if you will, and do a dinner in a city that's not their hometown. So in other words, I'm here in Pittsburgh basically because we're at the Duquesne Club, first of all, which is a great place to be. But it's also the home of my father. And I still have some family here, so it's just wonderful to be back here in Pittsburgh. The other added attraction, of course, in Pittsburgh is Keith Martin and Elysian Fields Farm Lane.
What did listeners miss?
Well, I think we missed the certainly a wonderful event here at the Duquesne Club, an opportunity to support the James Beard Foundation, which is the only foundation in America that's promoting the young chefs of our country and the cuisine of America.
Now, do you think that, Thomas, that they're going to do this again?
Well, it really depends on the success of these events. This is going on for the next several months around the country with different chefs doing their events in different cities. So hopefully we'll get great response from it, the guests will enjoy it, and ask us to do it next year.
That will be wonderful, and we'll get more advance notice next year as well, so we'll have the opportunity, listeners, to tell you more about it so you can plan it into your future. Now, let's more specifically say what they're going to miss is a wonderful dinner. Take us through the menu, Thomas.
Well, we have a wonderful menu. A lot of the things, certainly we're talking about seasonal items. Some of them are very special to us at the French Laundry and here at the Duquesne Club as well. One of them certainly being the Elysian Fields Farm Lamb from Keith Martin. We're doing that tonight. So it's a wonderful product, and we're always very happy to use it. Certainly another thing that we very much enjoy using is Hearts of Palm, which comes from our grower in Hawaii. So really bringing something from that state here to Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh in specific, that they may not have opportunities to experience very often. Another one of our wonderful courses is our sturgeon. And specifically using the caviar from the Sacramento River, from our white sturgeon in California. So using a domestic caviar and trying to reduce that.
Well, that sounds like it's almost too bad we missed it.
We'll now, get it next year.
Now, these are dishes that you do for Jose and the French Laundry also?
Yes, these are really indicative of what we're doing at the restaurants this time of the year. We have corn and chanterelle mushrooms with the lobster. We have sunchokes and onions and leeks with the lamb. So hearts of palm with radishes. So these are really indicative of what we're doing at the restaurants this time of the year.
Well, it just sounds like too much fun. Chef Kogana, you have a wonderful opportunity to host this event here at the club where you've been a chef for a very long time. What's it been like having the Keller team?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. Having Chef Keller and his team has been, first of all, a lot of anticipation, a lot of uncertainty, but in a very positive way. We have a new kitchen, and we're excited to have top caliber world-class chefs come into our kitchen to see it, to work in it, and to share their knowledge with our staff, which is probably the most important aspect of having them with us. Our staff gets to work alongside of them. They get to see new techniques, new ingredients, style of presentation, and for that, we're very thankful to be able to expand our horizons.
Now, there's a little bit of a special celebration for the club itself, I believe, in that you just opened a magnificent new wine cellar.
Yes, the wine cellar is called Matav. It's in the basement of the building. It was an older area that had some very unique and beautiful stonework. And we saved and salvaged that, and then we developed a wine cellar around that. So that's a tasting room outside with very nice glass panels that allow you to look into the wine cellar. It's a beautiful space for very small, intimate affairs.
If you've been asleep for the last 20 years, like Rip Van Winkle, then perhaps you have an excuse for not realizing that Chef Thomas Keller is one of the most celebrated in the world, and most people would name him the top chef in the United States, bar none. Thomas, tell us what it's like to be Thomas Keller, the restaurateur.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and Thomas Keller as a restaurateur is an odd thing, in the sense that I've always been a chef my entire 30 years, and so in the past couple of years, starting to make that transformation to being a restaurateur, and what that means is that I have more than one restaurant. Certainly, there are other chefs who have more than one restaurant and are still maintaining the title as chef. Myself, as a restaurateur, certainly being given the award by the James Beard Foundation this past year as Restaurateur of the Year, which is a great honor, but what it really means is that I have restaurants that I'm not actually the chef in. And I must say that the staff, the chefs that I have in those restaurants are wonderful chefs in their own right, and I'm really proud and honored to be with them. So being a restaurateur, from being a chef, is a bit of an oddity, but one I'm very proud of, because as I grow in my career, I'm able to give opportunities to other young culinarians to have an opportunity to be chefs at their own restaurants, and those restaurants are operated by myself.
Are you still a chef?
Not in the same sense that I was 3 years ago. In other words, I don't stand behind the stoves 16 hours a day as I once did in one kitchen. My responsibilities have grown considerably since we've opened, per se, in New York City, Bouchon in Las Vegas. Nonetheless, the philosophical approach that we take to our food is intact. The repertoire continues to evolve as it always has. And the culture that was established at the French Laundry is one that is very meaningful to us and very important to us to make sure that we continue to support. And that continues to evolve as well.
As a chef, do you still participate in inventing new dishes?
Well, the dishes that we are currently working on are in part what we have in season today, because we are truly a seasonal menu. They're dishes that have evolved from items that were on the menus for years. But they're also involved. We also believe in collaboration in our restaurants, so that anybody in our kitchen can have an impact on the menu, can make suggestions, can make additions. So as long as the philosophical approach to the food is in line with the philosophical approach that I have, then the chefs are welcome to have that kind of input.
What do you think is the secret of your success? By any measure, you've been immensely successful. You have a total of 7 Michelin stars. Only one chef, Alain Ducasse, has more. How did this happen?
I really have to say, and I've said this before, it's a lot of credit has to go to my current staff, as well as the staff that I've had in the past 12 years, 13 years actually at the French Laundry, who've made contributions to the foundation of what supports our restaurant and our restaurants today, that allows us to gain the recognition from places like Michelin that we respect highly. But it's really about the staff.
There isn't a personal secret in there. There must be a magic. There must be some magic that you think you have. Please share that with us.
Well, I think one of my strong points, and I learned this throughout my career, is that I spoke to this before. Is it's about collaboration. It's about allowing people to have an impact, take ownership, if you will, of the restaurants. Someone said to me a long time ago, "Treat it like it's yours, and one day it will be." And that's one of the philosophical approaches that I try to convey to young culinarians, the young dining room staff, so that one day they will have the opportunity to have their own restaurants.
A question Anne loves to ask. Unfortunately, she's not able to hear, so I'll ask it on her behalf. What's your favorite ingredient?
That's really a tough question. You've try to narrow it down to one, I think it would probably be salt, because without salt, the flavors of food become bland.
That's amazing. I mean, many chefs we have asked the same question have said exactly the same thing.
It's
really vitally important. In fact, Anne asked one chef, "Can you smell salt?" And she answered, "Yes, she could." And Anne said, "I can too. Can you?"
Yes, I think salt. You know, certainly salt has many different aromas, and it really depends on what it goes on.
But you can sense whether there's enough or not enough.
Yes,
side by smell.
There's hardly ever enough for me.
Now, when you're dining out. You're a busy man. When you're dining out, do you have favorite places that you like to go?
Yeah, of course I do. And certainly when I'm home in Yountville, you know, some of my favorite restaurants are restaurants that I haven't operated, places like Bouchon, which is just a wonderful, comforting place that I love to go back to over and over again for specific dishes, roast chicken, steak. Ad Hoc, which is our new restaurant, it's a family-style restaurant, which I love to go to as well. Outside of that, there are many restaurants across the country that are doing tremendous work today. Delfina San Francisco. I really enjoy El Voce in New York City. It's a great restaurant that I thoroughly enjoy. Alinea in Chicago is a tremendous restaurant. City Zen in Washington, D.C., another tremendous restaurant. Masa's in San Francisco is another one that I enjoy very much.
Now, so far you have two cookbooks out. One, the French Laundry cookbook, which one chef told us he read 14 times from cover to cover before he decided what he was trying to make out of it. One from Bouchon. Do you have another one in the works?
We do have another one in the works. It's called Under Pressure, and it's a cookbook that's being written specifically for the industry, for chefs, if you will, and it speaks to the technique of sous vide cooking.
Last question, and I asked you in the break if I could ask this question. Tell us a story about the lost shoes. Michael Ruhmann writes about the opening of Per Se, and you lost your shoes.
Michael Ruhmann is a close friend, and certainly he's very insightful to myself and to my feelings. When we opened Per Se, I like to take my shoes off in the kitchen. It allows me to walk around and be comfortable a little more. And Per Se is a really big kitchen. And so I was a little bit off balance there, and I lost my shoes. And it was really kind of a metaphor to opening a restaurant in a city that has high expectations. It was the city that I lived in and operated a restaurant in prior to that. And coming back to that city and opening that restaurant was something that was for myself was really a stressful situation, very high pressure, and I think I was just a little bit off balance that night.
Any last thoughts for our listeners, Thomas?
Well, I think that, you know, there are many things to say, but being here in Pittsburgh is really a pleasure for me. I think that one of the things that we all can do is try to increase the quality of our food. And one way to do that is to support your local farmers, your local suppliers, your local stores, and ask them to continue to bring in better food, higher quality food, fresher food, so that we can continue to have the opportunities that we have today.
Okay, well, we're going to try to catch up with one very famous local friend of Keith's, friend of Thomas's, friend of ours, Keith Martin, who has a new venture called Purebred, but we'll catch up with him about that on a future program, listeners, because I know you'll be fascinated with that story. Thomas, thank you so much for talking to us, and Chef Kogana for welcoming us to your...
It's an interesting thought, isn't it, listeners? Our first interview guest, Amelia, talked about local produce, local farmers, and Thomas Keller, star though he is, finished up on exactly the same point during our discussion. It was great to have him in Pittsburgh, and we certainly hope he comes again. And I really enjoyed his list of recommendations across the country, and I'm sure that you're delighted to have those secrets. Anyway, it's been fun to be with you again this week. Wasn't it nice to have Anne back on the program? And we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.